There's an old parable that makes a very important point about inner dialogue and the effect it can have on how we live our lives. It's a familiar story in Buddhist Zen circles. The story is about two celibate monks, a young man and an older man, and they're going on a pilgrimage. And they come to this river, and at the edge of the river, on the banks of the river, there's a beautiful young maiden, and she's unable to swim, so she asks the monks if one of them will carry her across the river on his shoulders. And the young monk immediately decides that he's going to be up to the task. He tells her to sit on his shoulders, and they swim across the river, and they come to the other bank, and the young monk puts her down, and off they go on their pilgrimage. And about 6 hours pass by, and you can see that the old monk is getting a kind of strained expression on his face. He's becoming more and more morose, and he has a frown, he has a grimace, and finally he can't contain himself. 6 hours have gone by. He looks at the young monk and he says, "I can't believe you did that." And the young monk says, "Did what?" He says, "Did that." He said, "Did what?" The old monk says, "Carry that woman on your shoulder. Remember, we are celibate monks." And the young monk says, "I put her down 6 hours ago. You're still carrying her." And the moral of the story is that true detachment comes in consciousness. It has nothing to do with what's happening in the physical world. In this case, for example, in the physical world, the young man carried her on his shoulder, but then he put her down and off he went on his pilgrimage. And the old monk just couldn't do that. He was still carrying her in his consciousness, which is where all of reality really happens. Negative inner dialogue is the result of a mindset that's always trying to overcome or resist difficulty instead of discovering the effortless solution that's always possible. And that solution will always do the least damage in the long run. Spiritual transformation rarely results from overcoming difficulty. It comes from finding easiness. It's not a matter of strain or force, because that creates corrosive inner dialogue. It's really the opposite of strain or force. One of the most important concepts in Ayurveda, which is the traditional science of life in India, is the concept of Agni. Agni is the inner fire that allows us to metabolize and transform whatever enters our system from the environment. For example, when we ingest food, the internal fire of Agni is responsible for digesting and processing the food into a form that will be useful and beneficial. But Agni also processes whatever we take in emotionally and intellectually. The internal fire transforms all this into usable form. And if Agni is functioning efficiently, there is no residue left over. There is no physical or emotional residue left to corrode or damage the human system. But that's exactly what negative inner dialogue is. Negative inner dialogue comes into being when the fire within you hasn't dealt effectively with the material it's encountered. There's an insight here that's extremely important to understand. When you are synchronized with the energy field that gave rise to you, when you are in balance physically, emotionally, and spiritually, you possess a level of strength and flexibility that is sufficient to meet any challenge effortlessly. But more than simply meeting any challenge, you can transform it in such a way that it nourishes you on your spiritual journey. Though a weak fire may be smothered, a brightly burning flame converts any obstacle that it meets with into fuel for itself. The anecdote about the two monks is meant to be amusing, but it also dramatizes the ability of a truly spiritual person to process a challenge and to do so with nothing left over. The monk even enjoys himself when he's doing it. But once it's done, it's done. His flame was strong to begin with, and now it's even stronger. The older monk, on the other hand, still has to learn this lesson. He has yet to develop this strength. He struggles to distance himself from the problem, while the younger monk literally takes it inside himself and transforms it to make himself stronger. In the parable, the younger monk finds a way to be always moving in one direction, while the older monk is inwardly divided against himself. This is the point we are all at until we reach a higher state of enlightenment. This is where we start from as people. Consciousness, after all, only exists because the energy field created a division within itself. The field created conscious thinking human beings as expressions of itself, and it did so in order to think about itself. We are an expression of that self-division that the field initiated. Our thoughts are not only ours, they are the universe thinking about itself. We are the inner dialogue of the conscious energy field, but all too often our thoughts take a form that hinders spiritual development, that is moving us in the direction opposite from which we want to go. Inner dialogue should help us regain unity consciousness with the field. Positive inner dialogue helps us move in that direction. It fosters synchronicity. It fosters spiritual development. The late Carlos Castaneda was one of the writers who really helped inaugurate interest in spiritual development in the United States and throughout the world. Some of Castaneda's ideas are extremely important for the kinds of inner dialogue we're discussing. Castaneda writes about four specific qualities of a spiritually evolved person, the kind of person who understands synchronicity and participates in synchrodestiny. These are the four qualities of the spiritual warrior, as he calls it: ruthlessness, cunning, patience, and sweetness. Right now, I want to discuss how each of these qualities plays a role in positive inner dialogue. I want to give my interpretation of how they apply to spiritual evolution and synchrodestiny. When we talk about ruthlessness in connection with spirituality, that might seem like an odd connection. Ruthlessness is a word that we usually apply to conquerors like Genghis Khan or Alexander the Great, or we can talk about ruthless gangsters, people who are determined to make a tremendous amount of money any way they can. That's what we usually mean by a ruthless person. But what Castaneda means by ruthlessness, and what it means in the context of synchrodestiny, is being ruthless in the destruction of the ego. Ruthless in searching out and eliminating ego-driven self-importance, because self-importance is the dragon that must be ruthlessly slain. Self-importance is an expression of ego needs, but it is not the final expression. If it were the final expression, self-importance would not be so damaging. But self-importance is only a precondition for a more destructive inner state, which is self-pity. This connection between self-importance and self-pity is one of the most striking insights in Carlos Castaneda's work. It took me completely by surprise when I first encountered it. Who would have thought that such a connection existed? Because when you think of someone who's self-important, you don't think of someone who feels sorry for himself. You don't think of a conqueror as someone who's pitying himself, or who feels frustrated because he's not getting the recognition he deserves. And yet, this is exactly what happens. The more power you have, the more important you feel you are, all that just creates greater and greater ego needs. As your needs increase, your frustration increases. The more you want, the more you feel that you're not getting as much as you deserve. In the ancient world, for example, the king of the Persian Empire wanted everyone and everything to pay homage to him. He didn't just want it, he needed it. The king's self-importance dictated that the whole world had to confirm his status as a supremely important person. So the king stood on the beach and ordered the ocean to stop making waves. But the ocean didn't pay any attention. The waves kept coming. So the king ordered the ocean to be whipped. In fact, he whipped it himself and made himself ridiculous. As powerful as the king was, he was frustrated that he wasn't even more powerful. He was frustrated that his power wasn't unlimited. Although he felt very important, he also managed to be sorry for himself. He felt self-important and he felt self-pity. And then he felt angry. Have you ever felt that way? Like you're not getting what you deserve based on how important you are? So you feel angry. Self-pity is what creates that anger. And self-pity is what creates negative inner dialogue. How do we ruthlessly fight the sequence of self-importance and self-pity in our inner dialogue? Where do you fight it? When do you fight it? We're going to take up all three of these questions: how, where, and when. But let's take the last two questions first, because they're a bit easier to answer. So, when and where do we begin this ruthless battle? To answer these questions, there's some good news and there's some bad news. The bad news is that probably the least critical time to ruthlessly fight self-importance is at a time like right now. When you're listening to a program like this, you're in the mood to think about these issues. You want to make progress. Your motivation is high. You've probably set a time to listen to this in relative peace and quiet. You're ready to give your attention to what you hear, and you're eager to act upon it. The good news is that there are going to be a million other chances to fight the battle of self-importance, but you've got to be able to fight this battle even when you don't really feel like it. In fact, especially when you don't really feel like it. It's not always easy when you're standing in the line of a supermarket checkout and somebody in front of you has 12 items, and the aisle you're in is supposed to be limited to 10 items, and you're very frustrated and you're very angry. At a time like that, you're ready to do anything in order to overcome the sense of injury to your self-importance. It's not easy when you're driving in a car and the guy in front of you is at a red light and won't move when the light changes, or when the telephone rings in the middle of dinner and it's somebody trying to sell you something. Those moments may seem unimportant by themselves, but they add up to create negative inner dialogue, and they add up to create the dragon of self-importance that you must slay. There's a very interesting story that makes this point. It's another story of a spiritual master and a young disciple in connection with this. The story concerns a young man who wanted to learn the Japanese art of stick fighting, which is called kendo. So he approached the master and he said, "I'd like to learn this art of stick fighting. I'll do whatever you tell me." The master replied, "Very well, we can start right now." But then the master just went on with what he was doing. So the disciple said, "What do you want me to do?" And the master said, "Well, as you can see, I'm here sweeping up my floor. You can help me with my sweeping." The young disciple didn't see what this really had to do with the art of stick fighting, but he picked up a broom and started to sweep. So for the next 3 or 4 days, all they did was chores around the house, and the whole subject of stick fighting never came up. It was never even mentioned. But then one day, when they were still doing household chores, the master suddenly reached out and whacked the young man over the head when he least expected it. The disciple was taken completely by surprise, and he asked, "What did you do that for?" But the master just looked at him and said, "Just keep sweeping, keep mopping, keep washing dishes." So they just continued on like that. But every once in a while, completely without warning, the master would suddenly whack the disciple over the head. Sometimes it wouldn't happen for a week, and sometimes months would go by, and once it took more than a year. But then one day, when it had been a long time between hits, the master suddenly whirled around to hit the disciple, and the disciple instinctively reached up with his hand and blocked the blow. Then the master smiled warmly and he said, "Now you are a master also." The point of this story is that constant inner vigilance is the true foundation of spiritual mastery. Constant inner vigilance against the dragon, especially during the most everyday tasks. The routine trials and tribulations that can really bring wear and tear to the soul. Spiritual transformation isn't a matter of technical skill. It doesn't depend on becoming an expert meditator only, or the ability to achieve difficult yoga postures. It depends on inner vigilance against an attack by the dragon, an attack of self-importance and self-pity. It's interesting that one of the best ways to control the demands of your own ego is to give genuine importance to other people. There are many ways to accomplish the same purpose. Whenever I visit someone's home, I always try to show my appreciation with a small gift. It doesn't have to be anything elaborate. In fact, that usually isn't appropriate. But just a small present or even a copy of a poem that the host might enjoy conveys a sense of thoughtfulness. It's surprising, though, that people seem to appreciate being asked for small favors almost more than they enjoy receiving them. That's an excellent way of making anyone feel significant and powerful. But you must mean it from your heart. If you're in someone's home and you see a book on a subject that interests you or that might be helpful in your work, ask your host's opinion of the book, or you might even inquire politely if you could borrow it. That's a spiritually healthy way of subordinating your ego to that of the other person. Conversely, when someone asks you for advice, when someone asks you to help them with a problem, listen with full attention and take your own ego out of the conversation. Resist the temptation of responding to someone's concerns with a narrative of how you've triumphed over even greater difficulties. It's surprising how often people fall into this pattern. Someone comes to you and says, "I'm so upset, I lost my wallet." And then you say, "Well, I lost my wallet last week and it had $300 in it, but I got it back through an amazing feat of ingenuity." A response like that is actually an attack by the dragon of self-importance. It diminishes what that person is feeling and inflates your own ego at their expense. There's another very powerful technique for ruthlessly attacking self-importance. Whenever possible, let other people take credit for a successful action. Even if it seems like it's going to diminish yourselves in the eyes of the world, always let other people take the credit if you have a choice. And remember that the truth will always come out eventually. If it was you who deserved the credit, eventually the truth will come out. And when it does, you'll get the recognition you deserve without giving in to ego-driven needs. I know of a young man who had just started working for a large corporation in an entry-level position, and his wife had a difficult delivery of their child. It was a cesarean section, and there was a bill that came to $20,000 for the surgery. And the man had a meeting with the chief executive of the company and said, "I'm having trouble with the insurance coverage. The insurance company is saying that they don't want to cover the hospital bill." And the chief executive said, "Well, I wish I could help you. I'll do what I can. I'll see if I can get the insurance company to cover it." And some time went by, and a few weeks passed, and then the young man got word that the bill had been covered, and he got a note from his boss saying that the insurance company had, in fact, covered the bill. It wasn't until many years later that the young man learned that, in fact, the boss had paid for this out of his own pocket. But eventually, the truth did come out. And when it did, it only increased the beauty and significance of this gesture. Because not only had the executive done something to help a person in need, but he had ruthlessly attacked his own self-importance at the same time. After ruthlessness, the second of Castaneda's four qualities is cunning. Cunning is the second tactic of a spiritually evolved person, another means for killing the 1,000-headed dragon of self-importance, as Carlos Castaneda calls it, and self-pity, which is the basis of negative inner dialogue. What does cunning mean in this context? It means not revealing your innermost self, not revealing most fragile inner feelings to the world in any kind of random way. It means using a great deal of discretion about the things that are most important to you. Later on, when we discuss intent in another session, we'll see that if you reveal your own intentions, if you reveal your own emotional intentions too easily, other people's intentions can get in the way. Other people's feelings can harm your own feelings, particularly if you're not really ready yet to reveal them. And that harm will lead to anger, to self-pity, to frustration, to harmful inner dialogue. Of course, this assumes that you do have inner feelings, that you do have a kind of very personal internal life that needs to be protected. And if you don't have this inner self, this almost secret self, then I suggest you create one right away. I think men need to be more aware of this than women. There's been some research that suggests men spend the early years of adulthood creating a kind of public self, an identity that establishes importance in the eyes of the world and of other men. This public self is based on career achievement, financial success, all the tangible attributes of a person who is making their way in the world. that kind of thing is understandably very important to young adults, but after the age of 40, it's no longer enough. The competitive side of our nature begins to diminish in favor of a desire for connection and inner satisfaction. The outward evidence of success is less important than the feeling that emotional and spiritual needs are being met. The danger is that people can wait too long without developing these very personal areas of their lives. You can devote every bit of your attention to creating the public self, but in that case, there may not be anything else when the public self stops being so important. The inner self and things that gratify the inner self deserve attention right from the beginning, but this inner self also needs to be sheltered and protected from the intentions of others. I think the ability to create that kind of shelter and protection is what Castaneda means by cunning. There's a very good film that shows the importance of the inner self and its sensitivity. The film was called The Shawshank Redemption, and it's based on a story by Stephen King. It's about a man who is innocent of any crime, but he finds himself in prison for a period of many years. And in order to survive, he's got to take a job working for the warden, doing menial work around the prison. It's very difficult and very humiliating, especially since he didn't deserve to be in prison in the first place. And in order to survive this, he begins digging a tunnel out of his jail cell. Every night he secretly digs a little bit on this tunnel, digging a hole through the wall with a stolen spoon. The hole is hidden behind a picture that he's hung on the wall. And every day, while he's doing his job around the prison, he calls upon his secret project to sustain him. He thinks about it. He thinks about the day far in the future when he'll be able to crawl into that hole that's taken so many years to create. He knows that someday he'll crawl into it and then emerge outside the prison walls. And every night when he works on the secret project, he's motivated to work harder because he knows that this is what's going to eventually get him away from the situation that he's in. He needs those two things. He needs his public self and he needs his private self. And each one reinforces the other. But obviously, if he were to reveal what he is doing in order to escape the prison, that would ruin everything. In a very literal way, his inner desires are too sensitive to reveal. The situation may not be quite that literal for you, but the point is the same. You must have an inner life, and you must cunningly protect it from the intentions of others, because those intentions may not completely coincide with your own. The third quality Castaneda writes about is patience. There's a story that during the Second World War, an American emissary was sent to Russia. At that time, Russia was engaged in a prolonged battle against Nazi Germany, and it didn't look like Russia was going to survive. The American emissary went to talk to the commanding general of the Russian military and said, "How do you think this is going to turn out?" And the Russian said, "We're going to win." Then the American said, "Well, how long do you think that's going to take? How much do you think it's going to cost in terms of money and in terms of human life?" The Russian general thought for a moment and then replied, "Those are questions that I never ask myself. I don't even think about how long it's going to take, and I don't think about how much it's going to cost, because I know that no matter how much I say it's going to cost, no matter how long I say it's going to take, that means it's going to cost even more, and it's going to take even longer. That's the only thing I know for certain. So I don't even think about those limits. The only thing I think about is the fact that we're going to win eventually." That's what patience really is. Patience is the ability to sustain an intention until it is realized. It's having faith in your ability to manifest your desires, faith that exists beyond time limits or any other boundaries. Now, I spoke earlier about how being in a car is a good place to fight self-importance, how someone can cut you off on the freeway and you can use that as an opportunity to ruthlessly confront your own ego. Well, a car is probably the best of all places to fight impatience. Have you ever been driving in a car with a young child and you've had to listen to the child saying over and over again, "Are we there yet? Are we almost there? Are we there yet?" Well, the child may be the only one who says it out loud, But we all have that feeling so many times during the day in different situations. But there seems to be something about driving in traffic that really brings impatience to the surface. I urge you to take advantage of that. The car is a place that doesn't seem like a situation where you would be confronting these spiritual issues, but that's precisely why it can be so useful. You drive down the street and you see today people banging on the steering wheel, you see people talking to themselves. It's very, very unlikely that the inner dialogue of those people is anything other than self-destructive. The last of Castaneda's four qualities is what he calls sweetness. Sweetness means impeccability. Impeccability in word and behavior. It means being playful without being negligent. It means you can never afford the luxury of being upset or of losing your temper, because if you do, then you're stoking the fires of anger. In fact, you really can't even afford anger even within your own heart, because it will express itself as angry inner dialogue. When that happens, you can't possibly master synchrodestiny, because you're impeding the very forces that you need to evolve to a higher level of consciousness. Sweetness is such a difficult word for us to understand today, and such a difficult thing for us to nurture, because we all want to seem intelligent, and many people associate intelligence with seriousness or even melancholy. We see people who are very serious, people who look grave, people who seem to have the weight of the world on their shoulders. And we might think, well, this is probably what an intelligent person should look like. I'll give it a try. Yet probably the most intelligent man that I'm aware of was a person by the name of John von Neumann. He was a physicist and an associate of Einstein's at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. He worked on the development of the first modern artificial intelligence and on early versions of the computer. He was a person who, if you asked him about a particular book, he would not only tell you that he'd read the book, but he could literally recite what he had read word for word. He could do that with books like Moby Dick or The Tale of Two Cities. This was a man who had a total photographic memory and also tremendous powers of logical analysis and mathematical insight. Von Neumann knew that he was smarter than everybody else, but that's not the only thing that made him a really unique person. He was also intelligent enough to know that people would resent him for his intelligence if he made it too conspicuous. People would hold it against him that he was smarter than they were, just as people can hold it against you if you're wealthier or more physically attractive. So throughout his life, John von Neumann made himself impeccable in word and behavior. Those are the terms that Castaneda uses to describe a person who cultivates the attribute of sweetness. Impeccable in word and behavior, both externally but also in what you tell yourself in your thoughts. We've devoted some significant attention to inner dialogue, and I hope this will help you realize the crucial role it plays in your spiritual life. Positive inner dialogue fosters connections with the conscious energy field, which in turn fosters synchronicity, which in turn fosters enlightenment. But remember also that the true goal of enlightenment is unity consciousness, to become one with spirit. And in unity consciousness, there is really no inner dialogue at all. There doesn't need to be any. Unity consciousness flourishes in silence. But it's a silence that somehow contains everything inside itself. Before the Big Bang, the whole universe was just pure potential, contained in only a few inches in diameter. In the same way, the silence of unity consciousness encompasses everything that has been said or could be said, and even everything that could be thought. That's the goal of spiritual transformation and the goal of synchrodestiny. It's a goal that may sound a bit abstract when you hear it described, so in the next session, we'll present some practical exercises to help you experience synchrodestiny for yourself.